From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. We'll celebrate a landmark birthday of an important Georgia organization today. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta was founded on July 1st, 70 years ago. And we'll continue the festivities next week with a special live show from the CDC. Join us next Friday for a look back at the group's long history fighting infectious, contagious, and communicable diseases.
A communicable disease is one which can be caught from someone else. This means that the germs have to leave the body of a sick person and enter the body of one who is well.
Today, we'll revisit some of our best conversations about issues that the CDC studies, like the harsh realities of secondhand smoke and the effectiveness of smoking regulations in Georgia. We wanted to know who the former smokers are in our audience and how they kicked the habit. Here are your first thoughts.
This is Marie Borowski calling from Marietta, Georgia. And there's a website posted, whyquit.com. Whyquit.com. Founded by a three-packet-a-day smoker. And you learn the science of what your body goes through during withdrawal. It was a key factor in my quitting, helping me understand the symptoms and the triumph that my body went through as I withdrew from the poisons that I was taking in. And that's what helped me.
Glad it did, Marie. If you have a tip to share, we definitely want to hear it. Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message like Marie did. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or post to the Facebook, and we might feature your comment on the show. Some people are squeamish around needles, so much so they'll go to great lengths to avoid getting a shot.
I was wondering if there was any alternative to the shots. I mean, really, I just hate the things.
May I ask why?
Well, because they hurt.
They hurt?
Yeah, they do.
Oh, very well. I'll give you tablets instead.
If you're like Jeff Goldblum in The Tall Guy there, we may have some good news for you. Researchers have created a tiny patch to replace needles in measles vaccinations. I talked about this in May of last year with Rebecca Martin of the CDC's Global Immunization Division. We were also joined by Mark Prausnitz. He teaches in the School of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering at Georgia Tech. Mark started off by explaining how this patch works.
Well, from the patient's perspective, it is, as you say, a little postage stamp-sized piece of paper that is pressed to the skin, left in place for about 20 minutes, during which time a vaccine is being administered into the body. But what you can see if you looked microscopically is that there are microscopically small needles that contain vaccine in them.
You need a microscope to see them. That's what microscopic means. You can't see these needles.
That's right. You just see kind of a texture. You can tell there's something there, but you certainly can't make out the needles because they're so small. But they do puncture into the very surface of the skin painlessly and then dissolve in the skin to release the vaccine encapsulated within.
You say it's painless, but how can I be sure you're telling the truth?
We have applied these microneedle patches to, at this point, more than 100 different people. And including myself.
Okay.
And we are consistently told by biased people like me and unbiased people, like just naive people from around Atlanta, that they don't hurt.
So, Rebecca, what's the benefit of a patch like this? Why is it so much better than the traditional needle and syringe?
Having a vaccine that you can deliver that is in stable, so you don't require a cold chain, which means you have to have a box, you have to have ice packs to deliver it, that you don't necessarily have to have a nurse or a trained healthcare worker to deliver it. And then in addition, there's no needles, there's no injections, and the space is being able to take it further into remote areas where you can actually vaccinate. And then lastly, the disposal of it. As you said, it's just a postage stamp size compared to having two syringes, a vial, as well as then all the other accoutrements that go with it. So it's really the incredible to be able to take it into further areas, remote areas, where we can reach children who are actually dying of measles. We see 20 million people infected every year with measles disease, and 400 deaths per day, which comes down to about 16 deaths per hour. So the ability to deliver this to areas where we can actually save lives, and in the WHO, the World Health Organization, the six regions all have elimination goals for measles. And within that, that means getting down to zero. And with that, we want to be able to reach more to save more lives. And this will be such a great tool to be able to do that.
All right, so I want to go a little bit further, Mark, into why this is such a great tool. Now, all these little microscopic needles that pierce your skin, as you say, you can't feel them, right?
Right.
You leave the patch on for how long?
Right now, it's 20 minutes.
Okay, and what's happening in that patch?
Well, these needles, which are solid needles, they have entered the upper layer of the skin, which is wet. The inside of your body is wet.
Yeah.
We've made the needles out of materials that are water-soluble. We use sugar, for example. We'll also use some polymers that are commonly used in medicine. And they get wet with the fluids of your body and then dissolve. It takes less than 20 minutes, so we wait a full 20 minutes just to make sure that the needles fully dissolve in that time.
And the benefit of this, and correct, I'm not a doctor, correct me if I'm wrong, the benefit of this and what Rebecca's talking about in terms of anyone being able to administer it is that you can't screw up the dosage. Anybody, you know, if you gave me one of these patches, I slap it on, that everyone's getting the exact same amount of measles vaccination, correct?
That's right. We actually just recently did a study. We haven't finished all the analysis yet, but we gave people these patches. We had them administer them, and afterwards we examined how much of the needle had dissolved.
Right.
And we found that people could very reliably, with minimal instruction, apply these patches to themselves and get the needles to fully dissolve in their skin.
So, Rebecca, I mean, obviously at the CDC, you're fully aware of the anti-vaxxing I don't want to say debate, but argument that has been going on in the United States. Does this in any way, shape, or form change that argument, or whether it's a patch or a needle, does that still force a small portion of the population, fill them with fear of chemicals?
I think, Celeste, to be honest, that issue will still remain because it is an anti-vaccine issue. But I don't want to speak on their behalf. But I do think on this that it really is, it removes the fear of the needles. And also one of the things that we have seen is it is a safe, effective vaccine with little adverse events. One of the steps with the current vaccine is because it comes as a dried pellet, you have to add liquid to make it back into a solution. And with that, we have seen some programmatic errors in some countries where they may have used the wrong liquid to actually make it into a solution. And so this will remove that step as well. So the opportunity for less errors, both programmatically, will be incredible with this and also reduce that sort of discussion.
And how long does this measles patch last at room temperature as opposed to, say, the syringe?
So we're doing studies on that, and we have done a study out to 3 or 4 months where we have stored it at
3 or 4 months
at room temperature,
and it remained viable,
and have found yes that it's remained stable during that time. And under refrigeration, we think it could be much longer. So one scenario is that the vaccine patch is kept out of the cold chain at all times. Another scenario would be that maybe it's kept under refrigeration during in the big cities and the major storage facilities, but then in the last mile of it, as the vaccine is brought out into small villages or it's being brought out as part of a vaccination campaign, then for that last period of time, the refrigeration could be removed.
And Rebecca, it seems to me that the benefits of that are clear. I mean, if you're trying to vaccinate people in remote places and you don't have to keep this refrigerated for 3 to 4 months, right? I mean, that's something that the CDC is incredibly interested in.
Oh, extremely, extremely. And I think this is why the partnership with Georgia Tech and CDC has been so valuable in moving forward this idea, bringing the skills and the assets of both of the institutions together. One of the things we've learned with polio eradication, where we're down now to 3 countries with polio endemic, is that really with polio vaccine, because it's drops, we can bring them house to house. We have not been able to do that so efficiently with measles vaccine, but this will actually allow us to do that. And in countries with fragile situations or in conflict, this will increase the opportunity to be able to reach those children and save lives.
I want to play you this comment from Patrice Harris. She oversees health services for Fulton County, and she's talking here about the increased cases that Georgia saw of measles that appear to be linked to international travel. Take a listen.
As you know, in the United States, measles was declared eliminated in 2000, and that was because of the high population immunity that we achieved by really very effective measles vaccine coverage. So a lot of folks haven't seen the results of measles. Measles can, in some cases, cause encephalitis, that's infection and inflammation of the brain, and even seizures and death.
How, Rebecca, might this, a patch like this that makes it easier, especially overseas, then affect herd immunity globally?
This is actually one of the things. If we can reach more children, we need to achieve 95% coverage with measles vaccine. Currently, globally, we have been stagnating at about 85%. And the majority of the world's cases are occurring in Africa, Eastern Mediterranean region, and Southeast Asia. But as you know, if there's measles anywhere, there's measles everywhere. And I think this is the point that it can travel very quickly and it knows no borders. So the ability for us to reach more children, achieve the high coverage, will allow for us, for the regions, to achieve their elimination goals, but then also to make sure that there is the higher population immunity with more children vaccinated.
Well then, Mark, let me play one more comment from Patrice Harris, again of Fulton County Health Services.
One is a religious exemption. You just have to have a notarized affidavit that vaccinations are against your religious belief. And another is a medical exemption. For example, if a child has an illness where they are immunocompromised, their physician might give them a medical exemption from getting vaccinated.
She's talking there about the obstacles to achieving 95%, you know, immunization, that there are exemptions here in Georgia. Now, in what ways are you hoping to use this patch for all of the vaccines? I mean, all those different shots that kids get during the first, you know, 8-9 years of their lives.
So we're discussing measles vaccine today, but we have worked on a number of other vaccines as well. We're optimistic that this patch could be useful for many different vaccines in the childhood vaccination series, in global
right.
immunization
measles
scenarios.
Usually comes with the MMR, right? Measles, mumps, rubella, you get those all in the same go.
That's right. So at this point, we have studied measles and rubella, and we hope to add mumps in as well. So we do hope to have an MMR patch that would be available. We think that this won't address all of the concerns that people might have about vaccines and why they may choose an exemption from vaccination. But there is a sizable fraction of people who are at least hesitant, and then some don't actually get vaccinated because of their fear of needles.
Does this make it cheaper to get a vaccination?
I don't expect that the manufacture of the vaccines will be cheaper in a microneedle patch format, probably be comparable, but the savings are in two areas. One is that you can have lesser trained personnel administer vaccines, and in the United States, in some cases, that might be self-administration. For example, a flu vaccine, and in developing countries, it might be in vaccination campaigns with minimally trained personnel. So that's a savings. And the other is that we expect to get the vaccine to more people. So we are preventing more illness, and that's a savings to the system as well.
And I should say, these are in clinical trials, which means it'll be years before these actually hit the regular consumer market, right?
That's right. It's still a few years off since we are doing first studies in humans now.
That is Georgia Tech's Mark Prausnitz, and we spoke with the CDC's Rebecca Martin. They're working on developing this patch for measles. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Spit on the ground, hold your breath, try to scare yourself to death. Bury your bones under the dirt and tear your heart and rip your shirt and stomp your feet in disgust. Curse the gray skies if you must, but you'll find when you are done, blue skies for everyone.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're spending today looking back at some of our best segments on research done with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Today marks the CDC's 70th anniversary, and we'll be broadcasting live from the CDC next Friday. Some of the things the CDC studies seem kind of obvious, like the Zika virus, for example, Ebola, HIV. Well, one of the many things it studies we didn't know about is violence. A CDC study last year used the Atlanta neighborhood of Buckhead as its testing ground. That's because the four-block area known as Buckhead Village was once an epicenter for nightlife. It used to be packed with dozens of bars, restaurants, and nightclubs. But by 2007, the bars were gone. So was the alcohol, and apparently, so was much of the violent crime. I talked about this last summer with Bob Brewer. He leads the CDC's alcohol program, and he's one of the authors of this study. He told me why he wanted to concentrate his research in Buckhead.
What we were really interested in, Celeste, is taking advantage of what was effectively a natural experiment from our perspective in our backyard, and in allowing us to look at what happens when you change the number and the concentration of bars and other establishments where people can go to drink within a particular neighborhood, and what effect that has specifically on violent crime. And we've known that there have been changes in the alcohol retail environment in Buckhead, but we hadn't really systematically evaluated how extensive those changes were, what the proportion of bars and the reduction in bars and other drinking establishments were over a period of time, and very specifically then the relationship between that and violent crime. And that's what we really wanted to look at in this study.
So how far did you go back?
Well, we went back to 1997, and we looked at really two different time periods. It was 1997 to 2002, and then 2003 to 2007. And the reason those two time periods were selected is that we knew that there had been an increase in the number of bars and other drinking establishments in Buckhead during that period of time, so we wanted to capture that increase. But then we knew that things had started to change around 2003 and that the number and concentration had started to decrease. We didn't know exactly how much until we got into the study, but we pinpointed those two time periods as being essentially the ones prior to the change in the retail environment and then starting with change and then afterward.
Well, one of the reasons why the change came about was because people became concerned about the amount of violent crime in that area. And I want to remind people of probably the most famous incident that happened around that time in Buckhead, and it was the murder of two men that involved NFL star Ray Lewis.
Outside the Cobalt Lounge nightclub in Atlanta, just hours after the 2000 Super Bowl, a fight breaks out, and when the dust settles, Jason Baker and Richard Lawler are stabbed to death left in the street. Ray Lewis and two friends, Joseph Sweeting and Reginald Oakley, are charged with murder.
So what is the connection between consumption of alcohol and crime? And how does that differ whether you're consuming the alcohol at home as opposed to a bar?
Well, we've known for a long time that there's a strong connection between particularly alcohol outlet density, that is, again, the number and concentration of bars in neighborhoods and violent crime. And we've actually looked at that by reviewing a number of studies that have assessed that relationship in many different locations around the country and, in fact, around the world. And I think when you're talking about outlet density, which, again, was the specific topic of this study.
And outlet density is just the number of bars in one tiny area.
Right. It's the, both the number and the concentration. Concentration. And,
right.
And I'm emphasizing that point about the concentration or density because we really think it's the combination of the two that matters a lot. When you have a large number of retail locations selling alcohol to drink on site or, frankly, to take somewhere else, you tend to get an increase in alcohol consumption. And some of that is probably due to competition, but it's also just due to increased availability. It's like if you have a large number of fast food restaurants in a community, you're more likely to consume fast foods. Similarly, if you have a large number of bars or other drinking establishments, people are more likely to drink and to drink at higher levels if they do. But the other factor here is when you have a high concentration of these bars in a particular geographic area, it becomes a magnet for drawing a lot of people into the community. And most of the people who are going to be going to drink at bars or other drinking establishments are not necessarily going to act violently or engage in antisocial behavior, but you're going to get a certain proportion of people that do. And we know that alcohol tends to reduce people's inhibitions, can affect their judgment, and for some people can make them violent.
So, and I want to make also clear about terms here that when we talk about violent crime, we're including assault. And that makes sense because oftentimes if people get drunk, they get in fights, right? Mm-hmm. That's pretty common.
Absolutely.
But it also includes things like robbery and murder. And I wonder, do we have any idea why, say, robberies would go up?
Yeah, again, I think there's a complex relationship here. Some of it may have to do with impaired judgment, may have to do with need for money as well. And a lot of people who are drinking at higher levels may have other drug problems going on that may lead them to rob to get money as well. So I think it's a complicated picture. But in our particular study, what we were looking at are what are called FBI Class 1 crimes. And as you said, that includes assaults, rape, robbery. It can include certain kinds of property damage, but it's were primarily crimes involving other individuals. And overwhelmingly, in all of the three areas that we looked at, Buckhead and Midtown and Downtown, which were our two comparison mm-hmm. areas, assault was by far the most common crime that we saw there.
And that, I guess, makes common sense.
Makes sense, exactly.
So, again, how far does the density affect it? So, in other words, let's say you're a small county and you give out a total of 1,000 liquor licenses for on-premise service, right, for bars or nightclubs mm-hmm. or whatever they may be. Does it change the violent crime statistics if they're spread out over the whole county as opposed to just being in the one area? I mean, what if a county says, well, we want to keep it all contained to the same place? We don't want bars spread throughout the whole living residential areas.
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and not one that we specifically were able to answer in this study. We do have the benefit of other studies that have been done before that, again, show that it seems to be both the number and the concentration
yeah.
that really matter. So if you have more places to drink, people will tend to drink more. But in terms of the risk of these bad public health outcomes, like violence, for example, it seems to be both the number and concentration. And in most areas in the country, honestly, you don't tend to find retail alcohol outlets, whether it's bars or liquor stores or whatever, evenly distributed across the area. There tend to be these concentrations. And there are a number of areas around the country that are struggling with these issues of alcohol outlet density. And I should point out, Celeste, that as a public health agency, I mean, our concern here is with the adverse public health outcomes that are related to this
right.
high concentration of retail alcohol outlets. I mean, in Georgia, for example, we estimate that there are about 2,500 deaths related to excessive alcohol use, most of which are due to binge drinking, actually, per year, and that the cost of excessive drinking is on the order of $6 billion, a large portion of which is paid for by government, by taxpayers. So the reason this is an issue of concern, outlet density and excessive drinking, is because it really is having a huge public health impact, and it's affecting all of us.
So what I hear you saying is the message from the CDC is not that you think bars cause violent crime, but that it can be a factor, and the good thing about knowing that is that that's something that can actually be controlled. Many things related to alcohol can't be controlled. This is one that could be controlled using zoning laws.
Yeah, I think that we do know that excessive drinking in general, binge drinking in particular, is associated with violent crime. So then the question is, what can you do about it? And what this study tells us is that one of the things that you can do about it that really can work is put reasonable controls on the number and concentration of bars within a particular community. Now, there are a number of other strategies that we know, based on strong scientific evidence, can work to reduce excessive drinking too. And a lot of them look a lot like the kinds of things that have worked well to address smoking. So, for example, alcohol consumption is very sensitive to price. If you increase the price of alcohol by 10%, you reduce consumption by about 7% across all different types of beverages. So that's an important strategy. Another important thing related to the retail environment is enforcing laws about who alcohol should be sold to. Not selling it to kids, not selling it to people who are drunk. Those are other strategies that sound very common sense, but that have also been shown to work to reduce excessive drinking. So we think a combination of those different strategies can really make a difference in reducing excessive drinking and harms related to it.
And of course, the next question that's going to come from any politician or somebody actually looking at zoning laws is, okay, what is that concentration then? And that, at what, I mean, how do we, can we arrive at that number, and how do you do that?
Yeah, that's absolutely something that we would like to have a clear understanding about. I'll tell you honestly, Celeste, that one of the challenges in doing a study, even to look at the relationship between reducing outlet density and violent crime, is that in general, the trend has been in the other direction. Most of the policy changes that we've seen around alcohol, I think, could fairly be characterized as deregulation, increasing alcohol availability, going from government ownership of liquor stores, for example, to privatizing alcohol sales. And I mean, I think you can have legitimate debates about these policies, but the net effect of them in many communities has been to substantially increase retail alcohol outlets. So much of what we know, honestly, about the relationship between retail alcohol outlets and excessive drinking is because of the fact that when you increase it, things get worse.
Okay, we've been speaking with Dr. Bob Brewer. He heads up the alcohol program at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or the CDC, of course. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
In In a lot of ways, the CDC has people on staff who are kind of like superheroes. Imagine an elite force of super spies, except they don't track foreign infiltrators. Instead, they look for viruses. That group is called the CDC's Epidemic Intelligence Service. They're informally known as the Disease Detectives, and they're based right here in Atlanta. The detectives work under a two-year fellowship program. I caught up with two of them last year. Rebecca Stewart-Schicker has worked for years as an ER nurse, and she's been assigned to work on influenza issues. And Selena Subaya is an emergency medicine resident now assigned to deal with global immunization. I asked her to explain what that means.
So we immunize against a host of things, but things that you're most familiar with are measles. Something I didn't know before I started is that measles kills 150,000 kids every single year. And the
thing about that, and when I read that statistic, was that we don't really take measles all that seriously here in the U.S., I guess because most of us are vaccinated.
Most of us are, and we're very lucky to have a strong health system where we can detect outbreaks and pretty much squash them before they get to a rate that's really high. But in other countries, they do deal with this daily.
So when they call you disease detectives, what exactly are you detecting? What is it that you're researching? What clues are you tracking down?
You know, I like to think of disease detectives by thinking about something that people are a little more familiar with, like a police detective. So a police detective is trying to get to the source of a crime, and a disease detective is trying to get to the source of a disease. So we want to know the who, when, where, what of a disease. So who is the disease occurring to? Where is it occurring? Why is it occurring? And what can we do to stop it, to prevent further illness and death?
So, I mean, some people may be more familiar with detecting disease because of the recent Ebola outbreak. And there was a lot of talk about trying to find patient zero, right? Where do these diseases come from? How do you even do that? I mean, if you're looking for a measles outbreak, for example, how do you find who was your first patient?
So I think detective is part of finding the first patient, but it's also part of finding everyone that's actually been infected once that outbreak starts. In outbreaks that are as big as Ebola and as big as some of the measles outbreaks that are going on in the world right now, it's probably impossible to find that one person that sparked the flame that resulted in the disease. And at that point, the question is it really that important to look for that one person, or is it more important to find the people that are getting infected and prevent it from spreading? So it's kind of a flexible term.
Okay, patient zero. But that's what we hear all the time in the movies.
It's true.
You're saying in the real life that, you know, it doesn't really matter.
It does matter. For some diseases, it does matter. But on the scope and scale of the large outbreak with Ebola, that's something where it would be very difficult to find. Something like MERS, though, is, you know, when the one patient came into the U.S., that's when we need to find patient zero in the U.S. And the same thing with the Ebola cases that started in the U.S. So
and
it really depends
MERS
on the
stands
setting.
For?
MERS stands for
Middle Eastern coronavirus.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We also had plague. There's a number of things that it seemed to be making a comeback, like we heard of a certain patients that have had plague. And these are the kinds that the CDC tries to track down where exactly they're coming from, why something like that would crop up again, right?
Yep, exactly. And that's a good example of where we're not as concerned about patient zero. We're just concerned about where are these people contracting plague and how can we stop that from happening?
Okay, so you are going to be doing this for 2 years. Why? I mean, I assume you already have a pretty good job. You're highly educated. What is it you get from this program that you can't get in the course of your regular employment?
Yeah, so EIS is just the premier program for training people in public health. And so as an ER nurse, I got to take care of patients every day with a variety of illnesses and injuries. But what I realized in the course of my work is that what I really wanted to do was figure out why those people had to come to the ER in the first place and how to prevent them from getting there. And I really feel like as a disease detective and as a public health practitioner, the work that I do has the possibility to impact not 20 patients a day, but maybe hundreds or even thousands of people. And that really inspires me.
How much of it is just convincing people to get their shots? I mean, especially when it comes to flu, you see people in the ER who are only coming to the hospital once it's serious enough to become a real risk, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And it can be difficult to convince people that it's important to get a flu vaccine. And that's a lot of the work that we do is doing the research so that we have the evidence to back it up and say, this is actually the single most important way to prevent yourself from getting the flu and to prevent yourself from complications from the flu, like hospitalizations and deaths.
Now, you guys are both getting ready to travel. Where are you going?
I'm heading to Kenya.
This is Selena, yeah.
Kenya and Laos.
Okay, and you'll be working with what diseases are you working with there?
So in Kenya, we're actually trying to see if text messaging will help us vaccinate 18 million children in the upcoming Kenya.
Text messaging?
Yeah, text messaging.
Does everyone have a cell phone in Kenya?
So Kenya actually had more cell phone subscriptions than people long before the world did.
More cell phone subscriptions than people?
Yes. Some people will have multiple cell phones or they'll have different SIM cards. Right now, we approximate that 85% of Kenyans will have access to a cell phone. So it'll help us reach areas that we couldn't otherwise get to, and it's a cheap, effective communication tool. But we're trying to see if how much we can increase people coming in to get their vaccines.
That's pretty fascinating. And you're traveling to where?
So I'll be traveling to Australia in September to evaluate a surveillance system for influenza that they have going in Australia.
I've been speaking with two disease detectives, Rebecca Stewart-Schichter and Selena Subaya. They are with the CDC, and they're working on influenza and immunizations worldwide. It's fascinating. Rebecca and Selena, thank you so much for coming in.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you, Celeste.
Thank you.
I'm Celeste Headlee. It's On Second Thought. We've spent the hour looking back at our most memorable conversations tied to research at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The Atlanta-based group turned 70 today and will help with the celebration next week when we broadcast live from the CDC. Our panel that day includes CDC Director Tom Frieden. And if you have questions for him, you can call us at 404-500-9457 and be sure to join us next Friday for that conversation. It's been more than half a century since people believed ads like this.
You know, if you were to follow a busy doctor as he makes his daily round of calls, you'd find yourself having a mighty busy time keeping up with him. Time out, for many men of medicine, usually means just long enough to enjoy a cigarette. Doctors in all branches of medicine, doctors in all parts of the country were asked, "What cigarette do you smoke, doctor?"
That's a commercial for Camel cigarettes from around 1949. Smoking is now on the decline nationwide, and Georgia ranks somewhere in the middle when it comes to the percentage of adult smokers. But there's a lot still going against the state when it comes to cutting down on tobacco use, especially among kids. I wanted to know more about these rates, so I turned to three experts. Alex Lieber is a data analyst for the American Cancer Society's Economic and Health Policy Research Program. Terry Pahacek teaches health management and policy at Georgia State University. And Brian King is a senior researcher with the CDC's Office on Smoking and Health. I spoke with him last year. Brian started off the conversation by breaking down Georgia's smoking rates.
So in terms of the smoking rate among Georgia adults, we're looking at about 19%. So it's a little slightly higher than the 18%
that we
see.
That's 1 in 5.
1 in 5, exactly. However, among youth, we're at about 13% for cigarettes, which is slightly lower than the national average of about 15%, but still quite high. And so we are seeing some declines in cigarette smoking over
what
time.
What is youth? Is that under 18?
Yes, that's under 18, okay. About 12 to 17 middle and high school students. But although we're seeing declines in cigarette smoking, we're seeing increases in the use of other products. So it's really important
like
to
look
vape,
at cigarettes
exactly,
and
e-cigarettes, hookah, smokeless tobacco, and flavored little cigars as well.
We're going to get into that in just a little bit. But first, let's talk about this report that came out of GSU. And Terry, first of all, let's talk about what you took away from this particular report, because there was a lot of things in there. Was there any surprising findings?
There were not surprising findings. They were unfortunate predictions coming true. In 2006, people knew what the science said, that 100% comprehensive law would be the best protection.
A complete smoking ban in public places.
Complete smoking ban in all enclosed places, bars, restaurants, and all places that people enter in the public. Unfortunately, the 2006 law left a loophole, an exception about how restaurants and bars, if they did not admit children, could have smoking designated areas or smoking permitted. Additionally, there was another little creak in the law about designated smoking areas, how that's defined. Problem. Suddenly, we now have a dramatic increase in the number of restaurants and bars that are permitting smoking. Instead of getting better protection, we're getting worse. And the worst aspect of it is that there's dramatic increase in the number of children exposed in these designated areas.
Yeah, that was very interesting. And Alex, let me bring this to you because we need to talk about how serious secondhand smoke is. And we do have more science than ever before on the effects that secondhand smoke is, especially on kids. How dangerous is it to be around someone smoking?
It's very dangerous. It can cause all kinds of respiratory illnesses and lung cancer. Currently, we know that secondhand smoke kills about 5,000 Americans every year, and that number is entirely preventable through comprehensive smoke-free air laws.
But does that require you to be around it every day?
It does. The persons who have these diseases are those who are married to smokers who are working in the hospitality industry. And so it's not easy to get cancer, but the best way to prevent it is to pass laws that protect people who cannot protect themselves, for example, from seeking employment in a place where they have to be exposed. And that's who these laws really, really protect.
One of the unfortunate facts that we've discovered in the last 10 to 15 years is that the highest number of people killed by secondhand smoke are from heart attacks. And even brief exposure, if you go into a place allowing smoking in a bar or restaurant for 30 minutes or a short period of time, for over 24 hours, for more than a day afterwards, your heart is ready to be tripped off into a heart attack. It changes the blood chemistry. That means that when you may go up a flight of stairs a few hours after leaving the bar and have a heart attack, you blame it on the stairs. But it was a smoke that tripped off the chemistry in your heart that caused the clot that killed you. And so most people don't realize that about 10 times as many people die of secondhand smoke heart attacks as die of cancer or other diseases.
Brian, let me bring you in on this, because there was a number of ways that we as a society try to combat smoking. I mean, one of them is these smoking bans. That we don't have a 100% smoking ban in Georgia, which is kind of why we're all sitting here talking right now. Restaurants and other places are finding ways around that. The other is through taxes. And this is something that we've spoken to I have spoken to the CDC about many times before. The American Lung Association has asked that Georgia increase its tax to $1.25 a pack. Right now, we have one of the lowest in the country. It's 37 cents a pack. Do taxes work to keep people from smoking?
Yes. Yeah. Bottom line is, increasing the price of tobacco products is the single most effective way to reduce consumption. And we know that from data at the local, state, national level. And right now, Georgia stands at 48th in the country with their 37-cent stamps for cigarettes. And so increasing the price of tobacco has been shown to reduce the prevalence of cigarette smoking among adults and also prevent initiation among youth.
That's what I was going to say. I was wondering if it has a bigger effect on youth because they have less money.
Yes, yes. We know that they can be particularly effective at preventing youth from accessing the products.
Let's take a listen. The FDA actually did a campaign called The Real Cost, an ad campaign to try and show the effects of smoking on your body, losing your teeth, damaging your skin, or this ad here. This is somebody being bullied by a cigarette.
Hey, when I say pause the movie, we pause the movie. Come on, big boy. Pucker up.
Cigarettes are bullies. Don't let tobacco control you.
And then the CDC had a campaign called Tips from Former Smokers. We still see those on the TV. This one features a woman named Terry. She had throat cancer and she had to have her entire larynx removed.
If you're a smoker, I have a tip for you. Make a video of yourself before all this happens. I wish I had. The only voice my grandson's ever heard is this one.
And Terry sadly died short in 2013 after filming another campaign ad. Alex, what do we know about what prevents people from beginning to smoke or gets them to stop smoking, and whether or not that's different if you're an adult or a kid?
So we know that, as Brian said, the tax increases are the best. Yeah, the best way.
That's the number one way. Is
absolutely
the price.
The number one way. You can do it again and again and again. When you make when you pass a law like going smoke free, you can only do it once. But that one time, we do know, helps people prevent from starting and will help them quit. But with tax increases, you can do it again and again and again.
Keep raising them.
Yes. And the more that you do that over time and you make cigarettes less affordable, you can continue to bring down the smoking rate. It's been proved all around the world and all around the country. The other things you can do, of course, are have comprehensive education campaigns with youth to teach them how to avoid the peer pressure that helps them start smoking. You can raise the age of initiation or of allowing people to start selling
where it's
tobacco.
Legal, right.
So there's new pushes to raise the age of selling tobacco to 21.
Same as alcohol, right?
Yes. So Hawaii just passed that. That's expected to be very, very strong. And then media campaigns are another way to go.
Well, let me bring that to you, Brian, because the CDC obviously invests relatively heavily in media campaigns. What have you guys found to work, especially in the difference between the ad campaigns that work with youth as opposed to adults?
So we found that the emotionally evocative, more graphic ads that really speak to you know the health effects of smoking can be particularly effective among adults. And that's what the CDC's Tips for Informed Smokers has used. And we found it to be highly successful. The first campaign in 2012, we estimate over 100,000 people quit, sustained quit as a result of that campaign. And we know that several others are calling quit lines and making those attempts to quit. So we know that they're effective and they're reaching the population. So it's definitely a good population level intervention to help reach the people who need that message.
And how's that different from reaching kids?
So for kids, there's different types of ads, but we generally know that the types of ads are very similar and that you have to, you know, speak to, you know, emotional and health effects, but it's not, as long-term health effects. It's more immediate. What's the immediate impact on children so that we can help prevent initiation and those more short-term outcomes?
So, Terry, let's go back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of secondhand smoking and restaurants getting around it here in Georgia. Why? I mean, if we're just talking about a restaurant that says, look, we want to be free to be able to serve everybody in our restaurant. These are brief encounters where you're only eating your dinner for 60 to 90 minutes. Why would it matter if we allow smoking inside the building or not? What would your answer be?
Well, first of all, children are being exposed, and of course, we all believe that we should protect children from things that could permanently damage their brains or their lungs. Secondly, the workers are being placed into a situation where they're asked to trade a paycheck for their health. The most heavily exposed people now in this country are hospitality workers, low-income workers, and they are more chronically exposed to it. Third, people do not understand that even this brief exposure, which you say, well, you know, I can smell a little bit of smoke, but it's not that much. But the chemistry shows that for over 24 hours after that exposure, you're at increased risk of heart attack, dropping dead. And that kind of thing is people do not realize that they are entering a place that could kill them. There's no sign that says, enter this place at your own choice, but you may be you're going to be exposed to 60 carcinogens and chemicals that could cause a heart attack within 24 hours after you leave this restaurant. If that was a bold sign in the front of the restaurant, enter if you don't
at
mind
your own risk, yeah.
being exposed to 250 toxic chemicals and 60 carcinogens, that's okay. But it's not that. That's not the kind of situation. There is not a public education campaign that makes people aware of the risk that they're coming into. And when you have that type of a situation, it is unfair. It's unfair that certain types of people are profiting off of these types of exceptions at the expense of their workers' health, the employees, particularly the low-income employees, and the unaware patrons. Evidence shows that business revenue in bars and restaurants goes up with 100% smoke-free. All across the world and all across this nation, in many types of places with excise tax or sales tax, revenue studies show if Georgia went smoke-free, its hospitality industry would make more money and would be more attractive to visiting tourists. This is good business to go 100% smoke-free. It's time to clean up the law. It was a mistake in 2000.
To leave the
loophole. It's time to make a good business choice, a good public image choice for Georgia, and clean up the law.
Alex, can we focus a little bit on the economics of tobacco and whether or not these things are a boon? Because the argument is always made for business in terms of being allowed to serve your customers. And then there's, of course, the economics of selling the cigarettes as well. What do we know about what benefit smoking is or is not economically?
So we know that Terry's absolutely right. With when you pass a smoking ban, because there are more people who do not use tobacco, we generally see businesses benefit from allowing a better environment for their non-smoking patrons. And that just happens across the board. In the larger economic picture, Georgia takes in about $200 million in tobacco tax revenue every year. However, it only spends about $1.7 million on preventing tobacco-related illnesses.
Where
so it's
does
about
the 196.3 other?
It goes into the general fund, from what I understand, and it doesn't go to preventing these illnesses that are caused by tobacco. But further, it gets worse. The state spends over $200 million on the Medicaid program's smoking-related expenses. And in the private health insurance sector, it goes into the billions.
Okay, let me try to get these numbers straight. We take in 200 million cigarette taxes. We only use 1.7 of that to prevent smoking. And then it costs us well over 200 million, the state, in Medicaid funds to treat smoking-related illnesses.
Absolutely. And if you include the entire smoking-related cost in our economy, it's over $7 billion.
Let me go to Brian here really quickly, because we have about a minute or a half left here, and I wanted to put to you this tweet, which I'm sure you remember, from the Surgeon General. At the end of Mad Men, the show Mad Men, the Surgeon General tweeted this: Mad Men ended and this should too. World's busiest airport can be its healthiest. Make Atlanta Airport tobacco free. You guys must have people coming in all the time through the airport. What's the comments made about the airport and all the smoke?
Yeah, I mean, the Atlanta Airport is really behind the times. They have over a dozen smoking rooms that were initially put there by the tobacco industry by Philip Morris during the 1996 Olympics, and they've continued to persist there. And we know from a study that CDC conducted in 2012 that the secondhand smoke is drifting outside of those rooms and exposing passersby to the dangerous chemicals and carcinogens that are in secondhand smoke. So it's really time, to get with the times and start tackling that issue of those smoking rooms in that airport, because there's plenty of other airports across this country that are operating perfectly fine without smoking rooms.
Brian King is a senior researcher with the CDC's Office on Smoking and Health. Terry Pachacek is a professor at Georgia State University's School of Public Health. And Alex Lieber is a data analyst for the American Cancer Society. Thanks so much to all three of you. That's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. Next Friday, we will mark the CDC's 70th anniversary with a live show from the agency's Atlanta headquarters. I'll talk with a host of CDC experts, including the director, Tom Frieden. So if you have a question for him, call us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us. Our handle is @OSTTalk, or as always, you can post it on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend.